Have you ever boarded a flight and just, implicitly trusted that everything is okay? That the pilot, the plane, it's all perfectly in order. There's this invisible web of rules and responsibilities keeping you safe, especially somewhere like Chile, with terrain that's so diverse, so challenging. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on exactly that. We're doing a deep dive into the fascinating world of Chilean aviation regulations.
Yeah, we've received a fantastic set of sources from one of you focusing on the really rigorous training and the regulatory environment for airline transport pilots in Chile. So our mission today is to kind of extract the most important nuggets of knowledge, give you a shortcut to understanding this complex but absolutely critical framework.
And what's really interesting here is that while we're focusing on Chile, these core principles, they echo across global aviation. Understanding how Chile does it helps us appreciate that universal commitment to safety, from the highest levels of law right down to the tiniest detail in a pilot's pre-flight checks. It's like a global safety ballet, but with local choreography. A global safety ballet, I like that. And what a performance it is. We'll explore everything from the basic laws and the role of Chile's Civil Aviation Authority, the DGAC, through pilot licensing, making sure the aircraft is airworthy, the details of VFR and IFR flight rules, how the sky itself is structured, dock crew responsibilities, and, that intricate dance pilots do with air traffic services. We're aiming to cover pretty much everything an ATP in Chile needs to know and why it matters to you. Okay, so when we think about aviation safety, where does the buck stop in Chile? How is that overarching control actually structured?
Well, right at the top, you've got the Dirección General de Aeronáutica Civil, the DGAC. That's Chile's National Civil Aviation Authority. And its history, its ties with the Ministry of Defense and the Air Force, they really highlight a very structured approach. The main law is the Chilean Aeronautical Code. That's Law 18.917. And this isn't just dry legalese, it's the bedrock. It establishes big principles like state sovereignty over airspace and the fundamental responsibilities of pilots. And then beneath that code, you get the more detailed DGAC regulations. These are known as DARs, aeronautical regulations, and BANs, aviation norms. They fill in the gaps.
So are these rules just for Chile then, or do they slot into a bigger global picture? I mean, you'd think aviation needs international standards, right?
Oh, absolutely. You're spot on. They definitely fit into that bigger global picture. DGAC regulations are closely aligned with ICAO standards and recommended practices, ICAO being the International Civil Aviation Organization. So for critical stuff like pilot licensing, aircraft ops, airworthiness, Chile's rules mirror international standards mostly, but with some, important local adaptations, Chile's geography demands it sometimes, and that global consistency is key for safe international flights. What's also interesting is the DGAC's dual role. It doesn't just make the rules, it also provides essential services, things like air traffic control, MET services, even airport firefighting.
Wow, that's a huge scope of responsibility.
Yeah.
So what happens if a pilot or maybe an airline doesn't follow these rules? What are the consequences?
Yeah, the DGAC has substantial enforcement power, which really underlines how seriously these regulations are taken. Violations can lead to administrative sanctions, think big fines or having your license suspended or even canceled outright. But for really serious stuff like imagine flying without a valid license or knowing the plane isn't airworthy. The Aeronautical Code steps into the criminal realm. It defines penalties that could, in really extreme cases, mean jail time. So compliance isn't just ticking boxes, it's upholding the whole safety system. The consequences are very real.
Right. So it's crystal clear then. For an airline transport pilot, understanding this whole framework isn't just, academic theory.
Right.
It directly shapes every single decision they make up there in the cockpit. It's about compliance, yes, but ultimately it's about keeping everyone safe. Okay, with that regulatory foundation sort of laid out, the next logical step is, well, who are the people mastering these rules? The pilots. What does it actually take to become a licensed pilot in Chile? And how does that career path look in terms of licenses?
The licensing structure in Chile, well, it mirrors global standards pretty closely. It's a clear tiered progression. It starts with the Piloto Privado de Avión, the PPO. That's for non-commercial, sort of personal or recreational flying. Minimum age is 18. Then you have the Piloto Comercial de Avión, the CPL. This lets you fly for money, for hire, maybe as a co-pilot on commercial flights, but there are limits. Still minimum age 18. And then the highest level, the one we're really focusing on, is the Piloto de Transport de Línea Aérea Avión, the ATPL. That's the top tier certification. Absolutely required to be pilot in command, the captain, on those big multi-crew transport aircraft in commercial air service. Minimum age for that is 21.
That sounds like a huge amount of effort, training, time. So what does the DGAC do to make sure that incredible level of qualification is actually maintained? It's not just a one-time test, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. Not a one-and-done deal at all. The real insight here, I think, is that an ATPL isn't just about logging hours or passing exams once. It's about a relentless, continuous validation of skill, of judgment. It really shows that aviation isn't a job you just qualify for once. You have to keep re-earning your command, basically. And the requirements are definitely tough, as laid out in DRA1, Chile's licensing regulation. Besides the age and holding a CPL and an instrument flight rating, you need extensive experience, typically around 1,500 total flight hours. And that includes significant time as pilot in command and instrument time, too. You have to complete comprehensive theory courses, pass tough written exams on advanced topics. Then there's the practical skill test, the check ride, often in a multi-engine plane or a very advanced simulator. And crucially, you need a valid Class 1 medical certificate. That means meeting the highest medical standards, and it's renewed annually or even every 6 months if you're over 60. Plus, Chilean pilot licenses aren't permanent. An ATPL is valid for 12 months. It needs periodic revalidation, proficiency checks, simulator checks if your license lapses. You might have to retake significant tests. And beyond the main license, pilots have to maintain other critical ratings, like the instrument rating. That's mandatory for flying in bad weather using instruments. It has to be kept current, usually checked every 6 months for airline pilots. And type ratings. These are specific endorsements needed for particular large or complex aircraft, like an Airbus A320 or a Boeing 767. Shows you're qualified for that specific plane.
Makes perfect sense. What about pilots coming from other countries? Can a foreign pilot just show up and fly commercially in Chile with their existing license?
Generally, no. A foreign license isn't automatically valid for commercial flying in Chile. There's a specific validation process with the DGAC. Often involves passing a Chilean air law exam, maybe a flight check too. And they need to demonstrate Spanish proficiency for domestic flights. For actual commercial air transport, like flying for an airline, a pilot would need to get a full Chilean equivalent license. It really underscores Chile's commitment to making sure everyone flying commercially in their airspace meets their specific standards. Even very experienced international pilots, it's about that uniform safety bar.
Right. So the licensing framework isn't just a barrier to entry. It's a demanding continuous pathway. Ensures only highly qualified, constantly assessed people are in command. Okay, let's shift focus now. From the pilot to the plane itself. What actually makes an aircraft legal to fly in Chile? What is this concept of airworthiness?
Airworthiness, put simply, means the aircraft meets its original design standards, its type design, and very importantly, it's in a condition for safe operation. Right now, having a valid certificate of airworthiness, a C of A, issued by the DGAC is absolutely mandatory, and the implication is serious. Flying an unairworthy aircraft is strictly forbidden. It can lead to severe sanctions, fines, even imprisonment under Chilean law. It's a fundamental safety gate.
Got it. So with that in mind, what are the key documents that absolutely must be on board a Chilean registered commercial aircraft, the things the pilot in command has to check?
The pilot in command, the PIC, has a direct legal duty to verify these docs before every single flight. It's part of their pre-flight routine. The essentials include the certificate of registration, the certificate of airworthiness, that C of A we just mentioned, and evidence of the latest airworthiness review, usually found in the technical logbook. That logbook also details recent maintenance, any open defects. Then you need the aircraft flight manual, or AFM, current weight and balance info that's crucial for performance, the radio station license, proof of insurance for liability, and while they're personal items, the crew's licenses and their medical certificates must be on board or on their person, ready for inspection. It's a pretty comprehensive checklist, leaves very little room for error.
I think our sources mentioned a handy mnemonic pilots sometimes use, something like AeroGil. What's that stand for? Does it actually help?
Ah, yes, AeroGil. It's quite common. It helps remember the key documents quickly. Airworthiness, registration, operating manual or AFM, weight and balance, journey log or technical log, insurance and licenses. It's a practical tool for that pre-flight check, but it's more than just paperwork, of course. Regular maintenance, following the approved schedule, complying with airworthiness directives, those mandatory safety fixes, that's all critical. And this is where the minimum equipment list, the MEL, comes into play. What's really fascinating here isn't just the list of required items, but how the MEL represents this sophisticated risk management calculation. It's where strict safety rules meet operational reality. It allows certain non-critical items to be inoperative under specific conditions without grounding the plane. It shows a deep understanding of redundancy in managing risk. So a flight can often proceed safely even if, say, a minor cabin light is out.
So the PIC's role is way more than just flying. It's this constant assessment of the aircraft's health. Checking the maintenance log, ensuring no inspections are overdue, understanding any MEL items, confirming all the paperwork. That's a heavy responsibility.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And flying an aircraft known to be unairworthy, that can void the insurance, bring heavy DGAC fines, license suspensions, even criminal charges. Pilots are always encouraged to be conservative. If there's any doubt, safety has to come first. Always.
Okay. Legal pilot, legal plane. Now, how do they actually navigate the skies? Legally and safely. Let's talk about the two basic ways pilots fly. Visual flight rules, VFR, and instrument flight rules, IFR.
Sure. Chilean VFR rules, they're pretty much aligned with international standards. The core idea is see and avoid. Oh, so that means you need good visibility and you need to stay well clear of clouds, especially in busier controlled airspace. For example, in controlled airspace above 3,000 feet, you typically need at least 5 kilometers visibility plus specific distances horizontally and vertically from clouds. Now, lower down, say below 2,000 feet above ground in uncontrolled airspace, it's a bit more relaxed, but you still need decent visibility and have to stay clear of clouds. ATC can grant special VFR clearance in controlled zones if the weather's marginal, usually just daytime though, it's an exception, and night VFR, generally more restricted. Often needs an instrument rating where you have to file an IFR flight plan simply because you can't see as well. There are also altitude limits for VFR. You can't fly VFR in Class A airspace. That's the high altitude stuff. And generally not above flight level 195 over mainland Chile. That's 19,500 feet. Over congested areas, towns, and cities, you have to stay at least 300 meters, that's about 1,000 feet, above the highest obstacle within 600 meters around you. For cruising altitudes above 900 meters AGL, there's the semicircular rule, based on your magnetic track. Odd thousands plus 500 feet for eastbound, even thousands plus 500 feet for westbound, helps keep traffic separated. And really important, if you file a VFR flight plan, maybe for a remote area crossing, it's absolutely critical you close it when you land safely. If you forget, search and rescue gets alerted.
Right, that makes sense for clear weather flying. But Chile has some serious mountains, often tricky weather. How does IFR flying differ when pilots are relying purely on instruments?
Yeah, IFR is a whole different ballgame. It always requires a mandatory flight plan and explicit clearance from air traffic control for every single flight. No exceptions. A really crucial rule for IFR minimum altitudes in Chile, especially with the Andes, is staying at least 600 meters. That's 2,000 feet above the highest obstacle within an 8-kilometer radius. That 2,000 feet over terrain buffer is non-negotiable for safety in mountainous areas. IFR cruising levels also follow the semicircular system if you're outside controlled airspace, but inside, ATC assigns your specific altitude. For landing, pilots have to strictly follow published instrument approach procedures. These guide them down safely to specific minimum altitudes, like the minimum descent altitude or decision altitude, and alternate airport requirements are standard. If the weather forecast for your destination is below certain minimum, say less than 5 kilometer visibility or a 600 meter ceiling, around your arrival time, you must plan for an alternate airport. Fuel planning is also precise. Enough fuel to get to your destination, then to your alternate plus a reserve. 45 minutes for prop planes, 30 minutes for jets. And of course, maintaining two-way radio contact with ATC is vital. There are specific procedures if you lose communications, including squawking 7600 on your transponder to alert ATC, and the other emergency codes, 7700 for a general emergency, 7500 for unlawful interference like a hijacking. There are also general rules for both VFR and IFR. Standard right-of-way rules apply. Aircraft in distress have priority. Head-on traffic alters right, overtaking aircraft pass on the right. Speed limits usually apply below 10,000 feet, typically 250 knots indicated airspeed. And while you must comply with ATC instructions, the pilot in command always has the final authority to deviate for safety in an emergency, but they have to report it afterwards.
Wow, that's a lot to keep straight. So what does this mean practically? Let's paint a picture. An ATP flying a turboprop over the Andes, maybe from Santiago down south somewhere.
Okay, yeah. In that scenario, they'd absolutely file an IFR flight plan. They'd meticulously check the MEAs, the minimum NRIT altitudes, and MOCAs, minimum obstacle clearance altitudes, for each leg. These are published minimum safe altitudes. They might plan to cruise at, say, flight level 200, so 20,000 feet, to clear the terrain safely. If unexpected thunderstorms pop up, they'd immediately talk to ATC, request a deviation around the weather. If the weather at their destination drops below the landing minimums, they execute the published missed approach procedure, climb back up, and divert to their pre-planned alternate airport. Every single step, from planning on the ground to reacting in the air, is guided by these regulations. It's all about managing risk in a challenging environment.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit. How is the actual sky over Chile organized? It's not just one big empty space up there, is it?
No, definitely not. It's a very carefully structured environment. Chile uses the standard ICAO airspace classification system, classes A, B, C, D, E, and G. Each class defines specific rules and what ATC services you get. It dictates how pilots have to operate. For instance, class A, that's usually high altitude airspace, say above flight level 195 over mainland Chile. It's IFR flights only, and ATC provides full separation between all aircraft. Class B could be around the very busiest airports. It allows both IFR and VFR, and ATC separates everyone from everyone. Class C is common for busy terminal areas around major airports and along airways. IFR traffic gets separated from everyone. VFR traffic gets separated from IFR and gets traffic info about other VFR flights. You need clearance to enter as VFR. Class D is often around smaller airports with control towers. IFRs are separated from other IFRs. VFRs get traffic info but aren't separated by ATC. Still need clearance to enter as VFR. Class E is interesting. Think of it as controlled airspace for IFR flights. ATC separates them. But VFR flights can operate freely without clearance as long as they follow VFR weather rules and keep a good lookout. And finally, Class G. That's uncontrolled airspace.
Yeah.
No ATC separation service. Pilots are responsible for seeing and avoiding each other, but you still get flight information service and alerting service.
That difference between controlled and uncontrolled and who gets separation, that's quite intricate. What about the really big regions of airspace?
Right. Chile's airspace is divided into three main flight information regions, or FIRs. There's the Santiago FIR, the Punta Arenas FIR covering the south, and the Easter Island FIR way out in the Pacific. Within these FIRs, Flight Information Service helps pilots, especially when they're outside those controlled classes of airspace, providing weather updates, traffic info, things like that. We also have special use airspace, things like prohibited areas, no flying allowed, usually for security reasons. Restricted areas flight might be limited, need permission, like military firing ranges. And danger areas warns of potential hazards, like craning activities.
And what about equipment? What do you absolutely need to fly in these different types of airspace?
Generally, in most controlled airspace classes, A, B, C, D, maybe E, depending, you'll need a working two-way radio and a transponder, specifically a mode C or mode S transponder, which reports your altitude automatically. If you're flying VFR in class D or G, you're strongly encouraged to squawk the standard VFR code anyway. It just helps ATC see you. And language-wise, Spanish is the main language for domestic ATC in Chile. English is used for international flights and often available on request. It's a system built for clarity. So practically, if you're flying VFR towards Santiago's Class C airspace, you absolutely have to call Santiago Approach Control and get clearance before you enter. Or if your chart shows an active restricted area right on your planned route, you must plan to fly around it. Knowing the airspace dictates your actions, keeps you legal, keeps you safe.
Okay, we've covered the rules of playing the sky, but what about the human element? Who's ultimately in charge up there, and what are their really deep responsibilities?
Yeah, the human element is central. At the absolute core is the pilot in command, the PIC. Article 65 of the Chilean Aeronautical Code actually designates the PIC as the sole and highest authority on board the aircraft. That's not just a fancy title. It means they have profound responsibility for the safe operation of the flight, for maintaining order, discipline, everything from preparing the flight until it's safely completed and shut down. And Article 67 lists some key PIC obligations. It's quite a list. Verifying all the aircraft documents, the crew licenses, ensuring the plane is actually airworthy before you even start the engines, reviewing all the weather information, proper flight planning fuel, performance calculations, weight and balance, maintaining complete operational control during the flight. They even have responsibility for cabin order, making sure people wear seatbelts, dealing with unruly passengers if needed. And there's a fascinating duty to render aid to other aircraft in distress if it's feasible and doesn't jeopardize their own flight.
Wow, that's an immense burden on the PIC. So besides the pilots, who else has to be on board for a typical commercial flight in Chile to be properly crewed?
Right, Chilean regulations are specific about crew composition too. A two-pilot crew is mandatory for any aircraft certified for two pilots. and it's generally required for commercial air transport flights with 10 or more passenger seats. So basically all airliners. On some older, more complex aircraft, you might still need a flight engineer if the aircraft's design certificate or the airline's ops manual requires one. Not so common these days. And then there's the cabin crew, the flight attendants. The minimum number isn't arbitrary. It's based on the number of passenger seats, specifically to ensure everyone can be evacuated within 90 seconds in an emergency. For example, you need at least one flight attendant for planes with 20 to 50 seats, two attendants for 51 to 100 seats. If you have over 100 seats, it's two, plus one additional attendant for every block of up to 50 seats above that 100 mark. So let's say an aircraft has 153 passenger seats. That would require, let's see, two for the first 100, then one for 101, 150, and one more for 151, 200 blocks. So four flight attendants minimum, all trained for safety and evacuation.
That makes sense. Now, fatigue is such a huge safety factor in aviation. We hear about it all the time. What are the specific rules in Chile limiting flight and duty times for pilots to prevent them getting exhausted?
Yes, fatigue management is taken extremely seriously. It's heavily regulated, and Chile's rules align closely with ICAO Annex 6 standards because fatigue is a known contributor to accidents. Generally, the maximum flight time, that's actual airborne time for a standard 2 pilot crew, is 8 hours in any 24-hour period. There are also cumulative limits to combat long-term fatigue buildup, like no more than 100 flight hours in any 30 consecutive days or 1,000 hours in a calendar year. Now, Chile has an interesting rule about multiple landings, recognizing they add to fatigue. If a pilot does more than 5 landings in one duty day, their maximum allowable flight time for that day gets reduced by 30 minutes for each additional landing beyond the 5th. So if a crew somehow did 7 landings in 24 hours, their max flight time would drop from 8 hours down to 7 hours for that day. The flight duty period, or FDP, that's the total time from reporting for duty until finishing duties after the last flight, is normally limited to 12 hours for a 2-pilot crew. It can be extended, maybe up to 14 hours for unforeseen delays, but then stricter rest requirements kick in afterwards. Like, you might need 17 hours of rest after a 14-hour duty, and there are specific restrictions on how many consecutive night duties pilots can do, again, to mitigate that sneaky cumulative fatigue.
Beyond just flying hours, are there rules about things like alcohol or drugs? Or even just showing up sick or overly tired?
Oh, absolutely. These are completely non-negotiable. There's a strict bottle-to-throttle rule. No alcohol consumption within 12 hours before starting any flight duty or flight. That's the DGAC rule. Crew members absolutely cannot fly if they're under the influence of alcohol or any substance that could impair their abilities, period. And importantly, crew must not fly if they feel unfit due to illness or fatigue. There are actually safe harbor provisions designed to encourage pilots to report if they're not fit to fly without fear of penalty. Safety comes first. And pilots must always adhere to their airline's operations manual and standard operating procedures, or SOPs, which have been approved by the DGAC. Ensures consistency. Think about this practical application. A captain starts their day. Part of their pre-flight is checking all the crew's licenses, medicals, and making sure everyone feels fit for duty. If the first officer mentions they only got 8 hours rest last night when the rules required 10, that flight cannot legally depart with that FO. They either need to get the proper rest or be replaced. It shows the direct, immediate impact these rules have on daily ops and the PIC's responsibility to make those tough go-no-go calls based on regulations and safety.
Okay, last major piece of the puzzle. How do pilots actually interact with this whole system? How do they talk to the ground, navigate within this structure? Let's dive into air traffic services in Chile.
Right. Chile's air traffic services, or ATS structure, is pretty comprehensive. You've got the area control centers, the ACCs. Santiago ACC handles central Chile and a huge chunk of the Pacific, including toward Easter Island. Punta Arenas ACC covers the far south. Then you have approach control units, or APP, for the busier major airports like Santiago. They sequence aircraft arriving and departing. Then aerodrome control, the tower, TWR, and ground control, GND, at towered airports. There's flight information service, or FIS, providing info to pilots outside controlled airspace. And the crucial alerting service. They're the ones who initiate search and rescue operations if a flight goes missing or reports being in distress. A flight being 30 minutes overdue usually triggers SAR.
So how does a flight even get started with ATC? Is it all automated now or still very procedural?
It starts with filing a flight plan. That's mandatory for all IFR flights and all commercial flights. These are usually filed with the Aeronautical Information Service, or AIS, or the Air Traffic Reporting Office, ARO, typically at least an hour before departure for a domestic IFR flight. And again, that critical point. Pilots must remember to close their flight plan upon landing safely, especially VFR ones, to prevent triggering a false alarm. For departure, the crew gets a departure clearance from ATC. This includes their cleared route, initial altitude, maybe a standard instrument departure, SID procedure to follow, and a specific transponder code to squawk. A full readback of this clearance is absolutely mandatory, word for word, basically, to catch any potential misunderstandings. It's a vital safety check. Once airborne and en route, pilots maintain continuous radio contact, getting position reports, especially if they're outside radar coverage. They might request altitude changes, step climbs for fuel efficiency, and they get traffic advisories from ATC. In an emergency, those transponder codes are key, 7700 for general emergency. 7600 means radio failure, tell ATC, I can hear you maybe, but I can't talk.
7500 is for unlawful interference, a hijack situation, and the pilot has a clear duty to declare mayday for imminent danger, or pan-pan for a less urgent but serious situation over the radio. Other key procedures include using radar services when available ATC, providing vectors, headings to fly, and separation, adhering to minimum safe altitudes, and importantly, questioning ATC if you think a clearance stakes you too low. Understanding the transition altitude and transition level, those points where you switch between using local pressure settings and standard pressure settings for your altimeter. Holding procedures if there are delays. Coordinating with adjacent ATC units when you cross FIR boundaries. And, of course, diligently checking NOTAMS notices to airmen before every flight for any last-minute changes, runway closures, navigation aid outages, etc. Plus getting briefings from AIs.
It really sounds like a continuous, complex conversation between the cockpit and the ground. Imagine that long flight, say Santiago, over the Pacific towards Auckland, New Zealand.
Exactly. For a flight like that, the crew files a detailed flight plan. They get an oceanic clearance from Santiago ACC, maybe covering the first few hours. Once they're beyond VHF radio range and radar coverage over the ocean, they'll use high-frequency radio, HF, or maybe satellite communications, SATCOM, to send regular position reports back to oceanic control. Then, hours later, as they approach New Zealand airspace, they coordinate and get handed off to Auckland Oceanic Control. And crucially, throughout the planning and the flight, they've briefed all the contingency procedures. What if an engine fails mid-Pacific? Where is the nearest suitable diversion airport? Maybe Easter Island? They need to know all that. It truly showcases the incredible coordination, the planning, the reliance on procedures and regulations needed for safe long-haul operations over vast remote areas.
Wow. What a journey we've just taken, conceptually. From those foundational laws governing Chilean skies, to the intense responsibilities of an airline transport pilot, the specific rules of VFR and IFR, that layered structure of airspace, the rigorous management of flight crews, and finally, that constant intricate life-saving dance with air traffic control.
And if you sort of connect all those dots, the bigger picture becomes really clear, doesn't it? Every single successful flight you take is the result of this incredibly robust, multi-layered system, all designed with safety as the absolute number one priority. It's really a testament to global standardization, but also to how systems adapt to local needs and challenges like Chile's unique and demanding geography. It's kind of a quiet miracle of human organization, of vigilance that we often just, well, take for granted when we fly.
Think about that next time you're settling into your seat. The sheer amount of detailed knowledge, the constant vigilance required for every single flight. How often do we step onto a plane and just implicitly trust this incredible, mostly unseen framework that makes air travel, statistically anyway, the safest way to get around? Maybe next time you fly, you'll notice a bit more of that invisible ballet playing out in the pre-flight checks, the engine sounds, the communication with the tower. It's all part of keeping you safe.